From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And we're pleased to welcome back Congressman Joe Morelli to Connections this hour. For so long, he entered the studio as one of the most seasoned leaders in government serving at the state level. Well, now he's a freshman in Washington serving a district that elected him just about 6 months ago. And this hour, we'll discuss a wide range of issues. We're going to talk health care, jobs, the Democratic presidential field, and more. Yes, we already have a lot of listener questions, and we will get to those as well, so let's not waste any more time. Congressman Joe Morelli, welcome back to Connections. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
I want to make sure we can hear you. Rob, are we hearing his mic there? I just want to make sure we... Joe, can I hear you? Do you hear yourself?
Very soft-spoken.
There you are.
Can you hear me?
I hear
Sorry.
You. You're a soft-spoken
a quiet,
member of Congress.
Soft-spoken.
I see.
Yeah.
You've changed since you've gone to Washington. You know, so 6 months into your tenure or so, how are you spending most of your days when you're in Washington? What's a day look like?
Well, you know, it is interesting. It's very fast-paced. And what's interesting about it is Albany is very similar to it. You go from meeting to meeting, and you have to really quickly shift gears from one subject to another. But honestly, in the last several years that I was in Albany, I was the majority leader, so I spent a lot of time on the floor running the House. And most people, I don't want this to sound the wrong way, but if they wanted to meet with me, they'd come to my office because I was sort of stuck there. So I was an easy target, but I wasn't very mobile. Here, you literally move from one building to the next, over to the Capitol for a vote, back to a hearing room. So it's really just really fast-paced. I think the only downside of it is the unfortunate part is a lot of people come to visit, and you're not always able to spend time with them. If you have floor votes, you have to be there. If you're in a committee hearing or you're and I have the assignment to be on the Rules Committee, which is longer hours. So that's the only part of it that that's been, a bit of a challenge. But you're moving a lot, and the subjects change with, as you can imagine, pretty rapidly.
How many hours a day are you spending raising money?
You know, interestingly, and I'm probably going to get beat up by this by folks on the political side of the world, but not very much. I actually have spent some time. Usually it's, early mornings. You may go to a coffee with people, that kind of thing, and you have to do some call time. But truthfully, we've been putting in routinely 11, 12-hour days, and almost none of it's fundraising.
So all of those things we hear, and they're not true? You don't
Well,
do
no,
that?
I think, honestly, I have the benefit of having had many years in office, so I have a pretty big network of people who have been friends and supporters over the years, and much of that shifted to this, so I'm probably just set up better than most people, most freshmen, but I think some of them do spend time. That's why I think when we passed HR1, which would allow the public financing of campaigns, although it's controversial from the point of view that some people aren't sure they want public monies to be spent to put television commercials on, supporting one candidate or another, but it does sort of take out all of that time that members have to spend. Dialing for dollars, as they say.
Well, I don't know if we're anywhere closer to actually seeing something like public financing of campaigns out of Washington, maybe not with the current political dynamic, but Harvard Law Professor Larry Lessig has made it sort of the cause of his career. He was on this program last month saying that until that changes, we don't really have a fully functioning democracy. Do you agree? Do you think we're anywhere closer to seeing that, and do you want to see it?
Well, I'd say a couple things about it. First, I'm not sure that the Senate, it currently constructed, is ever going to take it up. I probably think not. So it would have to be probably a Democratic Senate. Even then, you'd have to be able to deal with the, the 60-vote rule to end debates. I think we're probably a little closer to it. I would, the big caveat in all this, in my mind, is until Citizens United gets addressed in some way, you could find yourself in the perverse, having created this perverse situation where you might be bound by spending limits as a member of the House or Senate, and let's say you're limited to spend, pick a number, $1 million per House race. That's all you could raise. That's all you could spend. But an independent expenditure, not bound by any of those rules, and under Citizens United, has the freedom to spend whatever it wants effectively. Then you have this position where you might be limited and someone comes in and spends literally $5 million to your $1 million and you're bound by it. So I really think ending Citizens United or reforming it is sort of a prerequisite to really having a fully functional system. I also think this, that if you're running for Congress, you're running for city council, you're running for the state legislature, if you're not prepared to use and exercise independent judgment despite the fact that people give you money and contribute to your campaign, you shouldn't be in elective office. I've had to tell many people over the years, That I disagree with them, even when they contributed to a campaign. You have to be able to do that. What I hope people do is contribute to campaigns based on who they think is best suited to do it. I'm not Pollyannish to think that everybody who does make those contributions thinks that way. But as a legislator, you have a responsibility. And I'm very grateful for people who contribute to my campaigns. But I have to tell you, and this will probably not help my fundraising efforts, I don't look at my own filings. I don't know how much money people give me. I see people at events. I'm grateful for it. I wish people dealt with it more that way.
All right. So listeners like Matthew Gazzetta are representative of probably the steadiest stream of questions we've gotten for you today, which is whether you've had the chance to read the entire Mueller report, which I think you have not.
No.
Okay.
But no, the only thing members of the House of Representatives had is the 4-page summary.
The bar summary.
Yeah, the bar summary.
So they're essentially asking, do you agree with calls to release the full report? Do you think we're going to see the full report? And then assuming the answer is yes, beyond that, do you have a problem that it hasn't been released?
Yes, I have a problem that it hasn't been released. I think the Attorney General has had, you know, plenty of time now to send it to us. You know, and I think every situation is different, but as I understand it, and I wasn't there, but when independent counsel Kenneth Starr completed his report. It was a different statute, so this is special prosecutor versus independent counsel. But Kenneth Starr's entire report was submitted to the United States Congress. And then the Congress made decisions about what to redact for issues of either, well, in that case, national security would not have been an issue. But there are certain sensitive pieces of information that may be in the report that the Congress should look at and should not be made public. And there are sort of ground rules for doing that. But the question of whether or not the Congress gets it and is able to look at a report without the redactions, to me, is obvious. We have the responsibility of oversight and can't do it, particularly since the president, whether people like it or not, was at least was the central part of this investigation. And, you know, I think already a Barr, who has a pretty good reputation. I think he's served the country, served it well now in two administrations. But he's already coming under fire because, as you know, and I'm sure most listeners know, members of the Mueller team have at least gone to the press off the record to say that what the report's conclusions and findings are not reflected accurately in the Attorney General's 4-page submission to the Congress. So we do need to see it.
Yeah, journalist Glenn Greenwald has said this entire episode is a bigger embarrassment than the Iraq WMD hoax. And he says Democrats and many journalists have bought into a giant hoax from the beginning and should be ashamed, and it's time to move on. Do you disagree with that?
It's his point that
he thinks this was obvious, that there was never a conspiracy, that the president is not an agent of a foreign government, that this was sort of ginned up from the beginning, and that it is time to focus on real issues.
Well, look, you start with what we do know. What we do know is our national intelligence agencies all identified Russian interference in our elections. Only the president, really, of anybody of stature, disagrees with that. As far as I know, everybody has agreed to that. What's also clear is that the Trump campaign, including members of the president's family, met with people very closely connected with the Putin government. I'm not saying that necessarily means there's collusion. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but that's clearly what led to this investigation and prompted the deputy attorney general, after the attorney general, the previous attorney general, recused himself, to actually set up the investigation in the first place. So, to call it a hoax or to call it a big waste of money, it seems to me, no matter what the report and its conclusions are, this was an appropriate exercise to undertake.
All right. If you were voting in the Democratic presidential primary today, who gets your vote?
Well, I'm going to, pass on that.
I can't believe it.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Well, the field isn't fully formed. I think there are a number of really talented people in this group. Obviously, I know and work with Senator Gillibrand. I haven't had the chance to work with Cory Booker or Kamala Harris, but I think are very impressive. I think Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, has surprised people. I've only had a couple of conversations with Beto O'Rourke because he served in the House. We served together for the briefest of periods of time, but obviously had an impressive showing. But there's obviously the former vice president is being talked about. Stacey Abrams from Georgia has indicated that she might still enter the race. I saw my current colleague, Tim Ryan from Ohio, announced yesterday I think Terry McAuliffe, who's a former upstate New Yorker from Syracuse, who was governor of Virginia's. So I think people just, you know, I'm going to just take a deep breath. I'm going to continue to do my job and watch how it unfolds over the next several months.
So the only specific question I'll have then is you did invoke Senator Gillibrand, who I'm sure you know well. Why haven't you endorsed her?
Well, for the same reason. I told her that I wanted to watch what happens here. Here's the interesting thing, or not very interesting, which is I don't think anybody cares who Joe Morelli endorses. I certainly don't think – I've never really thought endorsements were as important as sometimes we seem to make them out. I don't think there's any – I don't think there's a single listener right now who would make a decision on who they're supporting for the nomination based on what Joe Morelli says. So,
well, you go to Washington and you get humility. Come on.
Yeah, I think humility is the most underrated – characteristic in humanity right now. I think more people should demonstrate it.
Are you feeling good about the field, though? Because eventually what the field needs to do is produce, if you're a Democrat, it needs to produce a candidate who can win. Are you feeling good about that?
Well, honestly, I think every single person in this field would have a reasonable chance to unseat the president. And I think the polling bears that out. I think, you know, the conversation rightly is, and look, the presidency is always about national priorities and what the rightful role and reach of government is. And, you know, there have been some elections in the past where it probably hasn't been, there haven't been stark differences. And you're starting to see now truly big differences between the parties and even within the parties about what their view of government and philosophically where we should be. So that's pretty exciting. I remember back, you were a child, Evan, in these days, but there was, during the 80s, there was a lot of national conversation about the difference between the Democrat and Republican parties. They used to say Tweedledee and Tweedledum, no difference between them. Boy, you know, here we are now. It's 30 years later, but what a shift. I mean, there are vast differences between the two parties, and there are, you know, as you rightly note, they're, you know, crowded field on the Democratic side, and they're all along the spectrum on what the rightful role ought to be, so...
You invoked Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Two of his ideas are, and his among others, are to abolish the Electoral College and to expand the size of the Supreme Court. Do you support either of those?
Well, I would certainly agree with the elimination of electors. It harkens back to the 18th century. It was in part a compromise, but also a distrust or mistrust that the founding fathers had in the average Americans, and so they had this idea of sort of this oligarchy, really. Even though they're for equality, they built an oligarchy in some ways. And it was also a way to protect the smaller states, which I understand, but now it's become outsized. You know, when you see Democratic candidate getting 3 million more votes in the popular vote, 3 million more votes than the victor. And this has now happened several times in recent memory. It didn't happen so much in the early days of the Republic. You really didn't have much difference between the Electoral College and the popular vote, but you do now. So I think a national popular vote makes a great deal of sense. Although I didn't love the idea of the compact, which is being formed. That's one way of getting at it. It's, I think, legal, although I suspect it'll be challenged in the courts. I think just doing a constitutional amendment that brings in the national popular vote and eliminates the Electoral College makes a great deal of sense. As it relates to the Supreme Court, I'll say this, and I won't be very popular for saying this. There are certain things that I think, if you were to look at the Supreme Court and say it needed to be expanded for reasons of just creating greater justice, equality of justice, that there was something fundamentally wrong with the number of judges. And maybe there's an argument to be made. I'm sure, Mayor Buttigieg has his reasons. If, however, it's simply because you don't like the outcome or the balance of the bench, I find that more problematic. I'd love to hear his reasons for it. I would note that in the 1930s, I believe, and I might be wrong on the timing. It was during the Roosevelt administration, so it may have been the early 40s, but I think it was the late 30s. President Roosevelt, frustrated with the Supreme Court and frustrated with the way some of the New Deal programs were being dealt with by the courts, sought to what they call pack the bench, which was to expand it. I think he wanted to expand it to 11, but he certainly wanted to increase the number. And then by virtue of doing that, he would be able to appoint all the remaining justices and have them confirmed by the Senate, and roundly pushed back on by people. And it didn't happen, obviously. So if this is an effort simply to have the next president, a Democrat, and I assume is what the mayor wants, to be able to reverse what's happened, then I would have problems with it. I don't like the outcome. I don't like who's sitting on the Supreme Court. The last pick, I think, should not have been confirmed. Having said that, we have a system, and if you're going to try to change the rules every time you don't like the outcome, then I think you end up with some really unintended consequences.
All right. On the subject of a Green New Deal, which has already been talked about on this program a number of times, and still a lot of questions about the specifics that are going to come into play. Generally speaking, you feel good about it, or at least the goals behind that underpin the Green New Deal?
Yeah, I think, climate change is an existential threat. I think at least Democrats believe that. I'm still, frankly, surprised. When I was in the New York State Legislature, obviously I had a lot of friends who were Republicans, and the difference between where we were and they were on a whole host of subjects was much more narrow than it is in the House of Representatives, where you have a much broader spectrum.
Interesting.
And yeah, that's, and I don't even know other than to say, I guess the closer you live, the more your attitudes tend to be a little closer or more closely aligned. But it's shocking to me how many members of the House don't believe climate change is even an issue. I mean, no one in the scientific community disputes it. I suppose, you could at least maybe have a reasonable question about what the direct man-made impacts have been of global change or of climate change. But to deny that it's even happening is just, I don't want to be impolite, but I don't know how you get there.
And just on the score, are you a skeptic then that anything can get done in Washington given that?
Well, I wonder about one of the interesting things. If you're a House Republican now, you're in the minority and you're sort of pushing back. But the Senate Republicans, if they want to hang on to the majority, they're going to have to start really, in my mind, getting with this a little more and to be really concerned about what's happening. They bear responsibility for what happens. And I'm hoping that they will become more thoughtful about it. They certainly have a handful of members of the Senate who I think are opening to having a conversation about this. Now, they may differ on tactics, but at least there's a group of them who will acknowledge that climate change is real. And whether it's, the percentage of the contribution man has made to it, because we've gone through warming and cooling of the planet in history. We had an ice age. Obviously, this is a real thing. But obviously, those of us who are Democrats not only believe that man has contributed dramatically to it, but that we need to work now actively to try to reverse its effects. I think there are a number of Republicans in the Senate who agree. So we just have to find common ground because we have to get moving. As it relates to the Green New Deal, there are a lot of people in the public and certainly a lot of members of the legislature in both houses who recognize that we need to move on this immediately, that there's no time to waste, that we're probably long past the time we should have been working on this. The specifics of it are not really well defined in terms of how to get the timetable that's been achieved. It also brings in other issues that I think if the focus is on climate change exclusively, you wouldn't necessarily bring in other issues around full employment, et cetera, which, again, are worthy goals, but whether they need to be tied up in the same resolution. Obviously, the Senate, I think the vote was 57-0. Is that what it was? And a handful of Democrats who voted against zero to 57, I guess I should say it that way. And the Democrats chose not to vote for it. I don't really know what went into their thinking on it, But I think what's good about it is it's focused people more. We have a select committee on climate change led by Kathy Castor, and I think they're making progress. I think the Standing Committee on Energy and Commerce, which New Yorkers like Paul Tonko serve on, it's a priority. We got to get moving. I don't know whether we have a partner. I'm pretty certain we don't have one in the White House, so it's kind of frustrating because it's hard to figure out in the next year and a half that any real progress gets made, but we're going to continue to push for it.
Sure, and I guess as a party, you would probably be thinking, what can we set ourselves up for should we win the next presidential election? And so looking ahead a little bit here, if you can get something done, would you support legislation that stops any expansion of fossil fuel production in this country?
That stops production in this country?
Yeah, fossil fuels of any kinds in terms of
fracking and those kinds of things, absolutely.
Yeah, oil, etc. Would you support any kind of resolution or legislation that calls for the stopping of using fossil fuels, essentially an infrastructure overhaul by the year 2030.
Well, I think, you know, I'd love to have that happen. I'm not sure how realistic it is because I'm not sure we're even going to get agreement on an infrastructure bill, which you would need to do to be able to make that conversion. So, and it would also, in some people's ideas, would mean that if you couldn't operate a internal combustion engine that uses gasoline within 10 years, again, I don't know if we can make that transition quickly enough. You have a huge, you know, automotive industry that relies on making cars, you know, so you have to sort of lay this out in a logical way. And there are many pieces or conditions that have to exist for you to get there. So, but I think we need to have a plan and start moving in that direction immediately. And I think some proposals like the carbon tax, I think, need to really be discussed and debated in a thoughtful way. I know some people in the environmental community oppose them. Others embrace them. So I don't even know if there's consensus around that. There's been a number of different ideas that have been kicked around. The cap and trade is obviously one.
Carbon fee and dividend.
The fee and dividend has been...
Is there one that stands out to you as where you'd prefer to go right now?
Well, I actually like elements of the fee and dividend proposal. I'm not sure that I think that if you're going to collect the fee, that it should be distributed to each household. I understand the rationale for doing it. But think about it, if you had dollars that there's a logic that says if you're going to raise dollars through a carbon tax, you should turn around and use those dollars on efforts and projects that will move you closer along to a carbon-free environment rather than to give them to individual households, as much as you or I might like to get a dividend on your utility bill. But it might be better spent on projects that help accelerate the development of renewable energy technologies.
Okay. Congressman Joe Morelli is our guest here. Let's get our first phone call. James in Fairport on the phone first with the congressman. Go ahead, James.
Congressman, I'm a registered Democrat, as are the other four members of my household. And I just find it amazing that you could go through a litany of people you think are good candidates for president in the Democratic Party without mentioning the two who actually have a concept and a track record in favor of the common man, and who would have some appeal to actually white people in the countryside. And that's Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Now, what's behind that?
Well, I actually didn't mean to exclude them. I certainly was. I was just going through a list.
You can't answer a question like that and not mention two of the one leading guy right now. And that's exactly what the party did and blew it last time.
All right, James, let's let him answer on Bernie Sanders. Go ahead.
I'm interested because it'll determine, you know, who we support in the future.
Okay, thanks, James. Go ahead.
Yeah, I certainly didn't mean to insult him. Obviously, at 20%+ of the Democratic electorate in the early polling, Senator Sanders is a force to be reckoned with. So I apologize, Jim. I didn't mean to. I was searching for the names, and I just, you know.
It was an unintentional omission?
Yeah, it's certainly not a slight.
Senator Warren?
Yeah, Senator Warren's obviously, you know, I think— she and Senator Sanders are sort of in the same space philosophically and ideologically, but she's obviously a top-line candidate. There's no question. And there's going to be others. I was just trying to go through. Actually, I ended up focusing more on the people who just announced, like Tim Ryan and others.
Top of mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, James.
Okay. On the subject of Senator Sanders or perhaps some other Democrats who have called for a more aggressive taxation on the wealthiest Americans, depending on the polling, Politico recently did a poll, and if you ask a broad question, do you support higher taxes on the wealthiest Americans? It's in the 60s. I mean, the answer yes is in the 60s, and it goes bipartisan. If you get more specific, it depends on the proposal.
Right.
But, you know, generally speaking, Americans are pretty favorable towards heavier taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Are you, and if you are there specific proposals you like?
Yeah, I would start at a couple places. First is Social Security. I talked about this during the campaign. I'm now co-sponsoring a bill by Congressman Larson out of Connecticut, which, you know, under the Social Security tax, you pay Social Security tax on the first $132,000 of income, earned income, and then it stops. And what the proposal does is once you get to a $400,000 or more in earned income for the year, the tax kicks in again. So it would help stabilize the Social Security trust fund. It would create solvency for the out years. I would do a similar thing as it relates to income taxes as well. And I think for the, you know, Senator Warren, for one, has talked about a wealth tax. I would certainly support some form of wealth tax. I think the number she uses is too low as a threshold because it's asset-based instead of income-based, and there are challenges with that. And that doesn't mean you're always have the kind of liquidity to pay, but I think wealthy individuals, I think they would, and frankly, I think when you're talking about people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and others, I think they would readily acknowledge that the wealthiest Americans and the income inequality issues that we face are such that you should have an income tax at a higher rate for wealthier individuals. At the state level, I supported proposals on $1 million for a single individual filing, $2 million for couples. We also had another incremental increase at the, I think, $10 million mark and higher and higher. So it just makes it more progressive at those levels.
Sure. My observation is within your party, whether it's Senator Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez or others who might refer to themselves as DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and obviously there's a distinction between full socialism and DSA, but there seems to be a debate about whether capitalism creates wealth or creates inequality. And I'm curious to know if you think capitalism generally is more of a driver of wealth or more of a driver of inequality.
Well, it's interesting. People have this discussion about socialism, which I guess on the far left you'd have communism, socialism, and then capitalism. And, you know, there isn't a purely socialist. I don't think there's a pure capitalist or communist country in the world. I do think that of the systems, in my mind, I've said this, and I'm sure I'll get criticized for it, but I think capitalism has been more to create wealth in the United States, certainly, and in the world than any other economic form. But I think all economic systems in their purest form have real weaknesses. As they have strengths, they have weaknesses. And where capitalism is not particularly good is on income distribution at times, and it leads to inequalities. That's why we have things like the minimum wage, prevailing wage, and other adjustments to it to try to help smooth out those disparities. And I think that's that's what I think the criticism or the weakness of the capitalist system. But I think when it comes to innovation and the gathering of capital and aggregating capital for production of goods, I don't think it has a rival in the world, and that's what's built the United States. But we do have to deal with the income inequality issues. And one of the interesting things is when you look particularly at what they're calling now this new transformation of the economy. And the transformation of technology, robotics, and what it's going to do to the labor force and the workforce, that usually as you go through these transformations, economic transformations, that the people who lose in a sense in it, they get pushed further down economically. And that, to me, is the great challenge in the next age, is how to incorporate robotics and productivity activities or productivity tools and what's going to be a changing workplace. How do you make sure that the people displaced have adequate resources to be able to have a quality of life?
Well, this is where I can't believe we haven't had a phone call from a supporter of Andrew Yang yet, who's also a Democratic presidential contender, who's one of his main issues is something that he calls the freedom dividend. We're actually going to, it's a form of UBI, Universal Basic Income, which we're going to talk about on this program next Thursday. Yang tweeted today, "Someone asked today how a mother of four should think about the freedom dividend. I responded as a parent, imagine if you knew every one of your children would start receiving $1,000 a month at age 18 for life. That's over $1 million, and that's a game changer." It's a form of universal basic income, starting at age 18, $1,000 a month from the government. And largely because Yang and some others and some other proponents of a UBI of some kind believe that we are reaching a tipping point with automation, and that even if we weren't, there are justice issues in play here. Do you support a universal basic income of any kind?
No. Or I would say not yet. I think there are a number of experiments that are going on. I see, unfortunately, in Canada, I guess they've pulled up roots on a project that they were doing. There's other countries that have done it. I haven't seen the results of any of it. I think it's complicated. You know, I think of even the programs that we're trying to operate that began in the 30s with Social Security and in the 60s with Medicare and Medicaid, that you make commitments and the challenge is to continue to recalibrate how you contribute to those programs, how you fund those programs, how you pay out those programs, and you do have to recalibrate them because the size of the workforce is changing, for instance. So if you go back and look at Social Security, for instance, at its beginning, you had a lot of people in the workforce. Life expectancy was much lower than it is now. And so people paid in, people get paid out, and the imbalance was the more money went in, they got paid out. And that happened for generations. Now we're coming to a point where you have both by virtue of demographics where many people in my age category, baby boomers, are going to start to retire. They're going to start to go into the Social Security system. You're going to have far fewer people in the workforce as a percentage of retirees than we've ever had. So you have to really figure out how do you recalibrate these and make them so they continue to be robust and solvent. Unfortunately, what happens is people lock in and say, well, we can't change it because to reduce this or to increase that, we can't have it happen. So you really have to be flexible in how you do this. And I do think we're coming up on a dramatic change in society, unlike anything we've ever seen. It's not the shift from agricultural to industrial revolution, industrial to it. This is a seismic shift in all this. So we have to rethink everything we do. So, but I just haven't seen UBI done in a way that gives me comfort that we're ready for it yet.
All right. This is our only break of the hour. When we come back, we'll get more of your feedback for Congressman Joe Morelli, who is with us in studio. He's served in Washington going on 6 months now, and we're talking about a wide range of issues. We'll talk health care and more on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, how would a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border impact security, commerce, the environment, and property rights? That's a question explored in a documentary called The Wall, created by journalists, and the film is coming to Rochester next week. We'll get a preview with one of the journalists that helped produce it. Join us Monday on The Next Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me go ahead and get a couple of feedback, a couple emails. Diane says, I was listening to the congressman's response to the question about whether or not he would support a bill that would put a stop to fossil fuel production. He didn't give a yes or no, and by dodging it, it makes me think the answer is actually no. How are we supposed to make progress with combating climate change if elected leaders don't have urgency to push policy through?
Well, I will say I wasn't sure whether you meant expansion beyond our current capabilities or whether you meant just simply stopping now the production of natural fuel, which or natural gas, for instance. And I don't if we stopped right now the production of natural gas domestically, I think fuel prices would rise dramatically, and we don't have an infrastructure that could do that. So I'm not sure I understand entirely the question. If you mean expanding, though, through fracking or more drilling than beyond what we have, I absolutely would oppose any efforts. I did it at the state level and will continue to do it at the federal
level. Sure. And then the other question, and to be fair, again, there were two separate questions. So maybe I'll kind of just put a fine point on Diane's email by saying it doesn't sound to me like beyond an expansion of fossil fuel production, it doesn't sound like you see a path to a system by 2030 in which when I pull up to fuel my car, I'm not pumping gasoline.
I mean, I don't say, look, if we move quickly to get there and we get there by 2030, I mean, you know, we're going to save the planet in shorter order than I think is possible to do. But for instance, you look at electrification, which is, you know, we're growing in leaps and bounds in terms of the percentage growth annually of electric cars, but it's still a relatively small percentage of people who own them. You have a huge infrastructure you have to build. I'm a big proponent, a big fan of hydrogen fuel cells. Hydrogen's the most plentiful element in the universe, and yet it has this annoying habit of always binding with another atom, so it makes water or other things. But you can take hydrogen out of water. You can take it out of other molecules and create it. And then, you know, the hydrogen fuel cell technology is growing at leaps and bounds as well. But you just don't have an infrastructure yet. To
scalability?
Build. Yeah, and that's really the issue here. We clearly know that renewables work in solar, in wind, in fuel cell technology, and in electric vehicles. The question is, how quickly can you get them to everyone? And is that affordable for the average American to do? I mean, the price is still relatively high. Hydrogen fuel cells, the challenge is the membrane, which allows the disassociation of electrons and protons, is precious metals. So we haven't found something that allows you to substitute that membrane for non-rare metals. And so it's working. We're pushing very hard to have this technology out, to continue to develop new technologies. But I think, you know, a date at which someone is certain you can do it by, I think, is eluded most people. But look, the goal ought to be as it was in New York. I think at one point we started with 50% reduction by 2030. They're trying to continue to accelerate those numbers. And so I certainly don't mean any disrespect, but you couldn't shut off natural gas today and have, you know, and have it work. It's just not possible.
So it sounds to me like you are in favor. You would love to see a world in which we're away from fossil fuels by 2030. It sounds like you're a skeptic that that could be fully possible by 2030 here.
Yeah, and I've seen no one lay out a plan to get there by 2030. And by the way, it would take right now. Here's another problem here, which is a practical and political problem. You don't have votes in the Senate to dramatically increase investment in renewables and smart metering and technologies to build a fueling infrastructure. So until you can do that, which would take, frankly, probably trillions of dollars, I don't think I'm underestimating that. And do I think that would be a worthwhile? If someone said you could if you spent $1 trillion over the next 10 years and you could have the answer to this, I would say sign me up tomorrow. Let's do it. But I don't think you have the votes for it, and I don't think the technology is in a position where you could do that and deploy it that quickly.
Paul writes in asking for some clarity about a dust-up that he was witnessing on social media regarding Israel-Palestine. He wants to know your position on Israel-Palestine. He's pointing out that there was some criticism this week that you posed for a photo at AIPAC with a man who has said he does not support the rights of Palestinians to their own state, and he wants clarification on your position on Israel-Palestine and your thoughts on the comments recently of your colleague Ilhan Omar, Representative Omar.
Okay. Well, that's a lot. I have publicly stated, and I believe this and said it over and over and over again, that we need a peaceful solution and a two-state solution, that I obviously believe in the right of Israel to exist and to prosper and to grow. And I also feel the same way about the Palestinian people, that they need a homeland. And I've been to the Palestinian Authority. I've met with Palestinians. I've been to Israel. And I think the only way to resolve the ongoing tensions that have befallen that region for, certainly since the declaration of the State of Israel, but long even before that, I mean, it goes back to biblical times. The only way to resolve this is peacefully and a negotiated settlement between those two parties that respects both and both's right to exist.
Okay. The colleagues from Representative Ilhan Omar, you did find them anti-Semitic, some of the comments?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think, and I'm not alone, certainly, I think the way that she used language, and I think, you know, look, I think she's a very, very thoughtful person. She's someone has a lot to say and a lot to contribute. She has a life experience that's different than most of ours. But I think that she relied on some language that I frankly thought was, sort of incited strong reaction. And AIPAC, which she referred to, which is the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, doesn't raise money. She talked about them giving out campaign contributions. They don't do that. They do have a presence in Capitol Hill, as they have around many state capitals around the country, and they're trying to promote American-Israeli relationships, and they do it pretty effectively. I was at the event. I think the situation in question, AIPAC, which is attended by every Democratic presidential campaign candidate, and almost all members of the House and Senate go and visit them when they come to Capitol Hill and they have an event. I got there late, but there was a member of the New York City Council. He asked if we could take a picture. We have common friends because he serves with many of my colleagues who have now on the New York City Council. We took the picture. I don't even know what he said. I don't know him. I met him.
You weren't aware of his comments before otherwise?
No, I actually think he made them since the photograph was taken. But in either case, I don't know. I didn't really even know what he said, but I hate to say this, but I got asked to take pictures three times today at different events with people. I usually politely accept, you know, if someone wants to take a picture with me, I do it. But I don't do background checks on them. I don't ask them. I don't even know the names of some people who ask me to take pictures with them. So I certainly wasn't endorsing what he said. I don't even know what he said. I don't know what his history is. He was a member of city council. I took the picture and got, you know, pretty heavily criticized, as I understand, for what he said. But this is what I say.
Does that frustrate you?
Well, it frustrates. This is what my position is well known. I've said it publicly. So why would you not pay attention to what I've said and instead, basically attribute what someone else said to me because I'm in a picture with him and ignore what I've actually said on this subject. So, you know, I'll tell you what I believe, whether you like it or not. And so anyway, that's my position.
And the last point on that is some of the other criticism was, well, you shouldn't have gone to AIPAC at all.
Yeah, but I mean, look, I am a supporter of Israel. I've been to Israel. I have friends who have family in Israel. So I support the Israelis. I think sometimes people confuse how they feel about Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel. But I say, if you're confused about that, think about this. Can you love America and not love Donald Trump or support Donald Trump? It's entirely analogous. I'm not a fan of Benjamin Netanyahu's, but I certainly support Israel. They've been longtime allies. They've been great allies. They're important allies in the world. And so I'm going to continue to support them. So I'll go to AIPAC, and I'll go meet with friends who are the Palestinian community. By the same token, I've gone to the Islamic Center on Westfall Road many times. I have many friends there. So, you know, what someone else said who's in a picture with me, I just think that's stretching it. And frankly, if you're in the public eye now, you get asked to take pictures every day, dozens of times with people. And I'm going to continue to do that because I think it's, you know— I think it's a nice thing to do, and but somebody equated it with being in a photograph with David Duke. I mean, I honestly, that's really troubling to me that someone would make that comparison.
Congressman Joe Morelli, my guest for the hour. On the subject of health care, you talked about Medicare for All during the campaign. That's obviously a term that a lot of the presidential candidates are talking about, that your party is discussing. Again, I don't know where the votes are in terms of necessarily getting it done, but where do you see that now, and what specific proposal do you support right now?
Well, so there are a number of proposals that have been put forward by my Democrat colleagues to get to universal health care, which is what I talked about often during the campaign and I talk about every day. Quality, affordable health care. As I said during the campaign, the question of whether it needs to be a single payer and must be a single payer system versus other ways of doing it, I'm open to on that question. The Rules Committee, which I serve on, is going to be having a hearing in the next month or so. I don't think we've finalized the date on the Medicare All proposal that's been submitted by my colleague Pramila Jayapal, who's the lead sponsor. I met with Pramila yesterday, continue to talk to her about it and members of her staff, and I'm anxious to look at the hearing. The House Budget Committee, which I also serve on, is doing a separate hearing on health care, but it will be more generally towards, I think, a number of different health care proposals and not on that single proposal. So we're going to have two hearings on the subject. You know, for me, the question is, in part, how does the financing work? How do we do this? What are the projected costs in the out years? Are the savings that people have suggested would occur in a single-payer system, is that a reasonable expectation? Clearly, you're going to, you know, people will look at administrative costs. They'll look at marketing costs in a system that has private payers, and whether or not taking that out helps basically cure the problems of access and affordability for people. So I'm open to the question, but I do want to know how it's going to work, what kind of disruption there'll be, what kind of disparities will result, because there are always disparities when you change big systems. But the Medicare system itself is not a single-payer system. And although they talk about Medicare for All, it's a little bit of a distortion of the phrase. Medicare right now doesn't have dental, doesn't have vision, doesn't have long-term care. It obviously applies only to people over the age of 65, and it's not paid for by Medicare taxes. It's paid in part for by Medicare taxes that we pay as a payroll deduction, but there's a significant general fund contribution to it as well. So the question is whether it's sustainable if you went to a system like that and put everybody into a single-payer system, and whether or not that leads to the best outcomes.
Yeah, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who's one of the few Democrats, I think, who has not declared for president. A lot of people expected him to, unless I missed it.
No, he actually said he was not going to run.
He's not going to run.
Yeah, he's not going to run.
He's talked about Medicare at 50 as a starting point. Is that more palatable to you?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the ideas that's being talked about. And what you would do then is you have to figure out what the costs are in, you know, per person, and you have to make sure that you basically either raise the Medicare rate, which right now and has been for many years, basically on your payroll stub, your employer pays 1.45% of whatever your paycheck is, your gross salary, and you match it. And but that would not be sufficient if you added another, you know, 15 years of people into the Medicare system. So you'd have to figure out how to finance that as well. Some people have talked about whether that be optional, whether you could opt in or opt out, choose to continue to have your private insurance company or your employer-provided insurance. So I think there are many ways of looking at it, and I think it's just to come to try to come to some consensus about what works best in getting everybody, every American, to have that affordable coverage.
All right. Elaine says she wants to see Joe Biden be the nominee, and she wants to know if you think he's gotten a raw deal on some of the way he interacts with people in the last week.
I don't think he's gotten a raw deal. I think, you know, I thought Speaker Pelosi said it well. She said she didn't think it was disqualifying what he did, but it is how people receive what you're doing, not how your intention as you do it. And he's going to have to, and I didn't see his entire statement, but he's clearly going to have to change the way that he operates and be much more mindful in the future of how, you know, in his physical space, whether or not it's welcome, and I'm sure will now change the way he deals with people. So I don't know whether it's disqualifying. I don't know whether he's going to run. I don't think he's gotten a raw deal in the sense that he hasn't said, I didn't do it. So he clearly made some people uncomfortable what he did, and you just have to be mindful when you're doing it. Are you making people uncomfortable? You're doing something that invades their personal space, and you can't do it.
Joseph online wants to know, what do you make of Ocasio-Cortez's rise, and does that say anything to you about the ideological rift in your party?
No, I think she's arguably the most popular member of the House of Representatives in its history. You know, while she has probably an equal number of detractors on the right, I think she has been courageous in saying things that she feels, whether or not she feels it's broadly accepted or not. She feels that it's important for her to speak out on these issues, which she has done. And, you know, I give her a lot of credit. We've only interacted a handful of times, but whether I agree with her on every issue is another matter. But I certainly think I give her a lot of credit for doing what I think in her heart she feels she has to do.
Okay. Do you think she is more of a representation of sort of a feeling of the moment, or kind of a direction that the party is going to eventually move to more wholesale?
Well, she's clearly changed the debate, which is a huge victory in and of itself. I mean, she has people talking about things in a way that they hadn't talked about them before. Whether or not they are a majority of the Democratic Party or not, or whether it is a very passionate minority of the party, I don't know. I think that this presidential campaign will help shine some light on how people feel. I also think there is, to some degree, an age difference. I think millennials look at the world differently, perceive it differently than people my age and people in between. And so we'll see over time who, and the great thing about this is the debate's going on. People can, you know, fall on either side of it, but it's good to have that discussion, to have it out there and look at the different policy choices.
All right, and around to Kuwait, this is Andrew. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, Joe, how are you?
I'm good, Andrew.
Hey, if you ever did get a UBI, you understand that a lot of people would not like the lottery to still be around if there was a UBI, because that would not work very well, in my opinion. What do you think?
I'm sorry, the lottery?
Are you saying
people
are going to take their government check and go gamble? Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's been any studies on that. I know that they're looking at it, but I don't think that's the issue. I think most people would use the resources if they had it to pay their rent or pay their mortgage and feed their families. I think that would be their first instinct. And I think the question is whether or not we're getting to a point of income inequality where people can't catch up or aren't ever going to be able to climb a career ladder that pays them enough to be able to care for their families and invest in their children's future. And that's, I think, when you get to a structural imbalance where that can't happen, then you have to look at alternative ways of making sure people can be successful.
Sure, and even people who have health care. I have said on this program that I think if you have a $6,000 deductible, you don't really have health care. Do you disagree?
No, you don't have health care, because what you're doing is you're so reluctant to pay the $6,000 out of pocket, you'll never really use it unless
it's
something catastrophic.
Sure, absolutely.
Right. That's essentially what you do. You're then effectively self-insured with a catastrophic, and you're paying for something you can't use.
Or in some cases, avoiding going to the hospital when you might need to.
Well, which is
out
which,
of fear of a
yeah. So so we try to bring premiums down. The idea was big high cost deductibles. People would have so-called skin in the game because they'd be paying for their own primary care. What we didn't count on was people avoiding primary care altogether because they didn't want to pay for it. But here, there's no free lunch. We're all going to pay for health care. There's no way with health care costs growing every year with people living longer. You know, unless we figure out how to really incent people to engage in wellness activities, healthcare is going to remain costly.
All right, 35 seconds. What else is on the top priority list for you going forward? What's most immediate right now?
Well, we're working on the budget. I'm going to, I think, probably manage the House budget resolution on the floor. As a member of the Rules Committee, that's going to fall to me as a member of the Budget Committee. That's a big deal. We're starting the appropriation process. We're going to obviously continue to go through what the Mueller report has. Me personally, I'm working on a whole host of legislation and appropriations that really are targeted at our region, which is my first responsibility.
Okay. Anything stand out that you want to mention as we walk away here?
Yeah, I talked about, you know, we renamed the post office for Louise, which I'm happy about. Gun shop safety bill, which I talked about in the campaign. We're getting close to introducing legislation on that as well.
We'll look forward to talking about that when that rolls out there.
Good. I look forward to coming back to talk about it.
Well, and let me just say again, now you're in Washington. I think this is your second time since you were elected. And you've always made time for the program. And now that you're in Washington, you're continuing to do that. It means a lot to our listeners. And I hope to see you again soon. Thank you.
You will. Thank you, Evan.
Congressman Joe Morelli joining us for the hour here on Connections. Thanks for all the feedback from listeners. And our thanks to the great team of volunteers and the team behind the glass, Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Wherever you are, have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.